presentation, and we will start with an informational meeting, Schools as Family and Community Resources. And Senator Duncan, would you like to make an announcement?
Mr. Chair, I mean, I was just going to comment, and I think it would be more formal introductions, but I think we really have an honor today that we have with us the... You've heard of Head Start.
Yep.
It's become a household word. Well, there's no doubt in anyone's mind who is the father of Head Start. And from Yale University, Dr. Ziegler is the father of Head Start. And I think it's an honor to have him here. I had a chance many times as the chief fiscal officer when we met with him and to see him in action. And he's really a very dedicated man and has had a major impact on the country. I think if you look back at some President Johnson asked him to put it all together, and he did it. And we know today what Head Start is, and I guess the only wish we all have is that Head Start programs were available for every child eligible for. It's a great idea. So that's all I wanted to comment on.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ziegler, and would you like to come to the table? And anyone else you'd like to bring to the table with you would be fine. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Hartung and members of the committee, my name is Janet Carlson. I am the committee administrator for the House Human Resources Committee, and our committee has been instrumental in bringing these two gentlemen to you today, and we're grateful that you have given us time on your agenda so we can also speak to the Senate side. As you heard Senator Duncan say, Dr. Ziegler is a renowned policy and program expert on children and families. He is from Yale University. He's a Sterling professor there, and he is also the director of the Bush Center in Child Development and Social Policy. He has advised numerous presidents and Congress on issues on children and families. He's the author or editor of 26 books, produced over 500 scholarly articles, and he's telling us that he has a new book in the works even as we speak. So I will, his bio is much too long. It will take the entire hearing if I go on much longer, but he has done many excellent things. Robert Goodlick, who goes by Sandy, is the director of the Office of Family Resource and Youth Services Centers in Kentucky. And Dr. Goodlick has, he oversees 602 centers in Kentucky that serve over 950 schools, and this was part of their School Reform Act in 1990. And a number of these Kentucky schools are part of the 21C model, the 21st Century Schools model, which is something that the Yale Bush Center is working with in many demonstration projects across the nation. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Ziegler.
Thank you. And Dr. Ziegler, it's an honor to have you here. We're very interested in Head Start over here, and I have some things I'd like to send by you after you're done with your presentation. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Duncan, for your kind words. Most of this means that I've been around for a very, very long time. My conceptualization of schools of the 21st century, or in Kentucky they're called family resource centers, and they're called, in my home state of Connecticut, they're also called family resource centers, but they're essentially the same model. This concept grew out of my lifelong study of children. Consistent with the ecological model of Yuri Bronfenbrenner, I am convinced that the child's growth trajectory is determined in great part by the experiences the child has in four systems. Probably the most important is the family system. The second is the health system. The third is the educational system, and the fourth is the child care system. Now, these systems do not operate in isolation, but are synergistic and impact each other, thus forming one megasystem, which constitutes a major component of the child's ecology. The interaction of these subsystems can be seen clearly in the case of child care and later schooling. If a child has experienced 5 years of poor quality child care before entering kindergarten, that child will not be optimally ready to enter school, and the child's later school performance will be compromised. the quality nationwide of the experiences of the child in two of these systems, namely schooling and child care, have now been called into question for many years. Beginning with the nation at risk almost 20 years ago, we have seen report after report noting the shortcomings of America's schooling. These concerns eventuated in the Educate America Act with its 8 goals, which were to be achieved by the year 2000. Probably the most important of the goals is Goal 1, namely that every child will arrive at school, kindergarten, optimally ready to learn. This goal is particularly important since we've discovered that school readiness is related to most subsequent school measures, use of special education or not, being in the right grade for age, all the way up to whether a child's outside of school. Probably the last study that one of the premier educator of my lifetime was a man named Ernest Boyer, and I'm sure you know of him. Mm-hmm. Before he died, Ernie did a study of just how many children in America arrive at school not ready to learn by the evaluation of the kindergarten teachers. He discovered, sadly, that 35% of America's children arrive at school not optimally ready to learn. In my discussions with inner-city superintendents, they say that for children at high risk, economically disadvantaged, that number is close to 60%. Why are so many of our children arriving at school not ready to learn? I think there are two major reasons. The first, too many of our children are not receiving the benefits of a preschool education. Whether a child receives preschool education or not in America is very much dependent on the child's income. Government Accounting Office in Washington did a report 2 or 3 years ago that says even with Head Start, only 35% of America's poor children receive a preschool education. What we find is the greater the income of the parent, the more likely the child is to have a preschool experience. So the lack of preschool is one of the factors, I think, that's holding back school readiness in this country. The second factor, I believe, is that many children's school readiness is being compromised by the negative effects of the poor quality child care they experienced before entering school. California, with whom I'm working, had a wonderful report that they put out 2 years ago in which the Committee of Californians recommended universal preschool education. And in that report, which is available to you, they also noted how many children's school readiness were being compromised by poor quality child care. So this brings us to the second subsystem that has been a topic of great concern and debate, namely child care. The fact is that our society has not been responsive to the dramatic change in the nature of the American family. I will note only two of the most striking changes that have all occurred within the past 30 years. The most obvious one is the huge increase in the mothers who are in the out-of-home workforce. Today, as we meet, mothers of babies under 1 year of age, 54% of those mothers are now in the out-of-home workforce. For preschoolers, that number is 62%. And for school-age children, today, 75% of the mothers of school-age children are now in the out-of-home workforce. Now, we kept thinking we were going to see an asymptote and this would level off. It never has. There's been a forward extrapolation done by the Census Bureau, which tells us that within about 20 years, 75-80% of all mothers will be in the out-of-home workforce. Well, as I pointed out, we're already up to 75% for school-age children, so there isn't that much more to go. The second huge demographic change, which is not as appreciated as the number of the increase in mothers in the out-of-home workforce, is the number of single-parent families in the United States. And when you hear the term single-parent families, translate that very quickly into women-headed families, because the 85-90% of single-parent families are headed by a woman. Today in the United States, 25% of all children are being raised in a single-parent home. And for our black citizens, that number is over 60%. These demographic changes in our society have produced a desperate need for child care, but we have never had a child care system in America. Instead, what we have is a hodgepodge of for-profits, attendant cares, not-for-profits, centers, family daycare homes, and babysitting by neighbors and relatives. This problem has been exacerbated further by welfare reform, which cannot possibly work without the provision of child care. Now, children of single parents and two working parent families are in this non-system for the five formative years before school, and here we find a major reason for a lack of school readiness. The care in our non-child care system in America is typically so poor as to compromise the cognitive and social growth of children. I have been tracking the child care literature since the very first study done in 1971 by the National Council of Jewish Women called Women's on Daycare. That was over a quarter of a century ago, and things have not gotten a bit better. I'm just going to quickly tell you about two recent studies. And this has surprised no one that the quality of care is so poor in America. The fact of the matter is that the average pay for child care workers in the United States is $7 an hour. First, let's look at family daycare homes. That's where we find most of the younger children. This is where a mother here in the state of Oregon, I understand, a family daycare mother could take in as many as 10 children. It's like having a small little business in your own home, a little tiny center. Well, there are two kinds of family daycare homes. There's regulated that meet the regulations of the state. And in the study that was done, only 12% of these family daycare homes were of high quality. For the unregulated homes, we call them underground, where people aren't registered. And there we find that only 3% are of good quality. Now remember that in America, 75% of family daycare homes are unregulated in what we call underground. Final study is a four-state cost quality outcome study. This was done in four states. 100 centers were looked at in each of four states. The states are really better off states. They were Connecticut, Colorado, California, and North Carolina. What they discovered in that study was that only 14% of the centers were of the kind of quality that we would want children to experience. Well, what's particularly sad in that study, there's a subset of centers which we call infant and toddler centers. These are for children who are three, birth to three. They discovered that 40% of these centers for infants and toddlers, never mind human development, they were so poor in quality that the health and safety of the children were being put at risk. We see here a gigantic disconnect between all this new knowledge about the developing brain and the importance of the first 3 years of life and what we're actually doing to children in the first 3 years of life in this country. Final note has to do with child care standards. It's a child care standard. There's no federal standards for child care. We thought we would have some 25 years ago. I've been working on child care standards since 1968 with the FDCR, Federal Interagency Daycare Requirements. So the standards really dictate what children are going to experience. The state standards dictate what they're going to experience in these centers. I've done a study in which we looked at it. It's available to you. It's published. We took the standards of the National Association for the Education of Young Children and we compared each state standards to those. And if any state matched those, we call that excellent. Not one state in America did. We had a lower level, which we call good. No state met that. What we discovered was that only 17 states in America had state standards that were what we call minimally acceptable. I'm pleased to report to you that Oregon is one of those 17 states. But back to child care. Originally, I thought that there would be a federal solution to the child care problem, the way Sweden or Denmark or France has solved the problem. So, working with John Brademus, who was then the whip in the House, and Fritz Mondale, who was then senator from Minnesota, I was one of the architects of the 1971 Child Development Act, which we foresaw, we legislated a national network of centers like to be found in Sweden and Denmark, which any family could access when payment of a fee calibrated income. That bill was passed by Congress, but it was vetoed by President Nixon, and as I remember, Pat Buchanan wrote the veto message. I'm now convinced that the federal government will never solve the child care problem. I think the child care problem is very much like education, either as mentioned in the Constitution, and it's going to be a matter that's left primarily to the states. It's very much like education. Now, with all that we hear from Washington about this educational initiative and that, the fact of the matter, as many of you know, only 7% of the education budget in this country is spent by the federal government. And that's about all we're ever going to get to take care of child care. So child care is going to be solved. It's going to be solved right here at the state level. Now, my effort to improve both child care and schooling outcomes led me to conceptualize the School of the 21st Century, or Family Resource Centers, as they're called in Connecticut and in Kentucky. I wanted the model to impact all four of the major systems that I mentioned to you earlier. So what I thought was needed is major school reform. I see this as a school reform effort. In the model, I propose that we make child care an integral part of the educational system. In a way, I reinvented the community school. I'm sure Senator Duncan remembers the community school movement about 25 or 30 years ago. The idea was you'd have a school in a neighborhood, and it wouldn't just educate children, it would fulfill the needs of the community in which it sat. Of course, the biggest need today is child care. I can give you the model very, very quickly. I'm sure Sandy will tell you more about it. First of all, what I propose is that we begin school at 3 for everyone. This isn't very revolutionary either. Italy starts school at 3. France starts school at 3. Well-off, middle-class parents have been sending their children at the age of 3 to private preschool for years. But what I propose is we make the day as long as the work day of mothers and fathers, so that for 3, 4, and 5, every child would get not only a good preschool education, but child care as well. This would finally see to it that every child received a preschool education and that parents have the child care they need. This is one component of the School of the 21st Century. Another component is before and after school care and summer vacation care for children through age of 12. I think this is very important. Whenever we think about child care, we always think about very young children. The fact of the matter is, 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8, 9, 10-year-old children should not be left to eat children. They should not be left alone. Many are frightened. We should take school-age child care very seriously. The payoff here is going to be really reduced delinquency as well. There's a very famous study done by Dr. Richardson, in which he demonstrated that twice as many children who are latchkey children are likely to use drugs and alcohol as those that are in a very good child care program. These findings have been replicated by other workers. It's interesting, when I was trying to sell this model in Hawaii, the piece they picked up was the school-age piece, so that today in Hawaii, every child in the state has before school, after school, and summer vacation care, heavily subsidized by the state, but each parent pays on a calibrated scale, calibrated income. Now, if you just do these two components, you solve all the child care problems from ages 3 through 12. Other components of the school of the 21st century. First, any child that is born in the catchment area of the school, somebody from the school goes to the home and becomes a supportive home visitor for the parent and plays that role for 3 years before the child gets to school. This is so consistent with the brain research. It's very obvious. That's where we want to get in there at birth and see that something, that the child is getting the right surrounding environment for those first 3 years before they ever get to school. The model that I use is the parents as teachers model in Missouri, which is now found in every school in the state of Missouri and is in 2,000 other sites in America. In fact, they have just redone their curriculum to incorporate all the new brain research work. The second, another component of the model, family daycare is very heterogeneous in quality, but it's going to be here as long into the future as I could possibly see. And a lot of parents like it. They weren't raised in centers. They like the idea of their child being in a home. What I propose is that we take all of the family daycare homes around the school, network them, make the school the hub of the network, and use that hub to train, monitor, and support family daycare mothers. I propose that every one of these schools have an information and referral system, which is not very complicated because there are all kinds of services that families need. And we need some kind of source that families could turn to find information they need about other benefits, programs that are available to them. I propose that every one of the schools in the 21st century have a health component. Now, after giving you this bare-bones outline of what schools of the 21st century look like, let me inform you quickly that I do not believe these schools should be a cookie-cutter approach. Some of this I learned from my experience with Head Start. Like any good community school, these schools ought to meet the particular needs of the community in which they find themselves. That's why we usually start up our schools in the 21st century with a needs assessment. What does that community need? And communities vary in what they need. So what you will find all over our schools or family resource centers that have different kinds of programs. Some include programs having to do with teenage pregnancy, some on adult literacy. Some of the schools in their needs assessment said, hey, we have to have an infant and toddler center, and they have modeled infant and toddler centers. Now, the growth of these schools in America have been really phenomenal. They captured people. This was just a speech a little over 10 years ago. I gave it, and our superintendent was there and said, I could do that. So the first schools were developed in attendance back in 1988, and that's as long as this model has been in place. Independent of Sandy's magnificent story, there are 500 of these schools in 17 states. In the state of Connecticut, a legislator liked this idea and got us legislation to produce three. What happens is once people in the next district see these schools, they have to have one. So what is happening in Connecticut is we move from 3 to 90 in 7 or 8 years. The Family Resource Centers in Kentucky is probably the greatest success story that I know in terms of a statewide effort, and Sammy will tell you about that. They're growing rapidly in Arkansas with state support. In addition to state support, there are a variety of ways that these schools have been funded. The child care component has been typically funded simply by sliding fee scales paid by parents. Sometimes Title I money is used. Local foundations, businesses contribute money. There is a flexibility in the model. The school can either mount these programs within the school, or they can contract for services outside of the school building. But I do think it's important that this be seen as education, and that schools provide the umbrella and be accountable. A lot of things have happened since the country's moving in this direction. We'll either move to it sooner or later. For instance, right now, 30 states in the United States do have some sort of preschool programs. A few with extended day programs. Georgia has such a model, but there's 30 other states. Some have gone to categorical route, saying the difficult poor children. I much prefer the universal route that's been pursued by Georgia, New York, and now Connecticut. The most important aspect, and one that seems hardest to sell, although it strikes me as the most obvious, is the quality of these programs. We have research study after research study which shows that the benefits accruing to these programs are related to the quality of the programs. There's been much research done, and I couldn't begin to tell you all of it, but some is fairly the Prairie Preschool Program, where they found that a 2-year high-quality preschool program, they did a cost-benefit analysis and discovered that for every dollar spent, he saved $7 in later expenses. Parents and Teachers Program, is all by itself, has shown better school performance by the children who have received parents and teachers as visitors, and much more involvement in the schools by the parents, which happens to be the 8th goal of Education America Act. Wherever we find good school-age daycare, we find less delinquency and better school achievement. We've done some early studies of 21C schools, and we find benefits to the child, to the parents, and to the school itself. For children who have been in the program for 3 years, we find higher mathematics and reading achievement. Unsurprisingly, for children in these schools, we find better school readiness. And for the benefits for the school itself, we find reduced vandalism, increased parent involvement in the schools, and parent appreciation for the school. I think I'll quit at this point.
Thank you very much. That's most interesting, and I appreciate you leaving some time for Sandy there, because we do have to vacate this room at 3 o'clock. But I have a question for you, and I just would appreciate you say yes or no, and regardless of what you say, why a staff person will connect with you. But on March 15th, we had a hearing here on Head Start. Ron Herndon from Portland is the national president.
Hello, Ron.
Sure, of Head Start. And I tell you, the testimony was really compelling. In fact, Senator Shannon asked a question of the three ladies that were seated there. They had experience with their own children in Head Start, and now they were doing volunteer work and so forth. The senator didn't have a question. She just said, "You women are beautiful. Beautiful because what they had done for their children, for their families, and what the prospects." So that got me thinking about why can't we have Head Start schools chartered like public charter schools? And you don't need to say yes or no to that yet. But this legislature, we're now beginning our 14th week, we have spent a lot of time on a public charter school law. Senate Bill 100 passed the House, Senate about 10 weeks ago, and just passed last Thursday in this House. And so what we are trying to do now is to figure out concur in the House amendments or not concur or to change it. But what I would like to see done is to include, all the traditional schools that could become a public charter school is the Head Start program. And I talked to Senator Gordon Smith personally and to Senator Ron Wyden's staff, and they heartily endorsed the idea of pursuing to see if that's workable. And one reason that I think that it could work, the president has said in the last two State of the Union messages, I have $60 billion for 100,000 new teachers and for charter schools and vouchers. Right now, 34 states have about 1,300 charter schools. But if we could open up the possibility of Head Start being chartered that way, in the state of Oregon, right now, the governor's budget calls for funding, I believe, at about 43% of the total eligibles. The Senate has a budget that we need $8.8 million to get to 50%. We have 17,000 students in Oregon that are eligible for Head Start. Oregon is about 1% of everything in the United States, of the other 49 states. I would like to see Oregon become a pilot program for bringing in Head Start schools as public charter schools over a period of time. We couldn't do it overnight. We don't have the infrastructure and all that. But does that idea make sense at all?
I would think it makes sense. I would think a bit larger, Mr. Chairman. 40% of the schools that I have just told you about include Head Start. It's not, I mean, don't start, you know, we got hung up in the 60s with some inoculation models. You do something wonderful for a couple of years, that'll do it. You really have to think in terms of the first 12 years of a child's life to make a big difference. What I would suggest is incorporate Head Start into, make that the preschool piece, just add people who are not poor so that you do something else when you do that. What are problems with Head Start? Is it segregated? Do we really want all poor kids in one set of sites and all richer kids somewhere else? I think we should push for integration. So what I would recommend is make charter schools out of this whole school model, but include Head Start as the preschool piece. And then you could have it both ways. And I guarantee it'll have a bigger impact, because what we've discovered is that our old idea that, you know, 1 year of intervention for a poor kid is going to be enough, we have studies that show that you need several years. So this model gives you a much longer time in which to impact the child and the family. So I think you could do both of these and just incorporate them.
Well, fine. And I posed the same question to Alex Medler, who is the charter school specialist for the U.S. Department of Education. And he pretty much said that you have just said, but anyway, there'll be a staff person by the name of Karen Smith, who worked for Senator Hatfield in Washington, D.C. for 8.5 years, will be picking your brain about how we might make this happen. So thank you for your comments, Cindy Shannon.
I have a couple of questions. a lot of questions for the man from Kentucky, but you mentioned about these, I don't know what you call, what you envision schools to be, with all these standards in them. You mentioned taking Title I funds to make this successful. And
for poor children.
Huh?
For poor children.
Right, but then when you use those funds and get creative, you're taking dollars away from what was education. And I'm talking about the whole. I was reading through some of the things. And I'll tell you one thing that will promote charter schools anyplace. And I think if we actually hear the man from Kentucky, we need to hear some parents from Kentucky, because there are a lot of parents that send their kids to school. They actually literally send their children to school. They don't want to send them to a place where there's drug counseling, drug rehabilitation, where there's employment opportunities, referrals for the community, and all these other things that you offer in these centers in one part of the school. And I think that Title I funds should go to educate poor children, not have some kind of a family referral office or space and actions in a school. I think school should be for education, and they go to welfare office if they want to.
Well, Senator Shannon, the money I'm talking about spending this money on preschool education. And if you're interested in school readiness, you have to spend your money there. So I'm not talking about any. I'm talking about educational reform. these other services, they're not there just to provide some kind of do-goodism. The fact is we have learned that unless a child has got good child care, he's not going to be very good in school. That's why we find better achievement scores if we're providing both. All I'm saying is extend the school day so that, and if you hear mothers and fathers talk about it, they love these schools because they have a terrible need for child care. I was saying earlier, I mean, we've got buildings. You know, the buildings at Hall schools in America cost roughly $2 trillion. And we don't use them fully. No businessman would operate that way. Why not have these children? Why not have latchkey programs in the school? There's learning that goes on in those latchkey programs.
Mr. Stigler, there's a whole lot more in this 21st century than all-day daycare. I don't think that the family resource centers should be in the schools, because I've read more about the 21st century school. It's even so that the public school buses would be open to anybody that wanted to go for a needle exchange program or whatever they were doing at the drug rehabilitation room at the school. It's all open, because that's the goal of the 21st century is to make the schools, yes, we do education, but we do all these community service things too. You could even sign up for your unemployment check in the pure, if you had it your way, 21st century school, according to the book.
The schools can't do anything other than the schools decide to do. There's no mandate. I don't know of any drug programs in our schools.
Well, that's what this literature says.
Yeah. Unless a community decides they want to have a program. So it's the parents who are making that decision, not us. I gave you what the model was.
Well, Senator, may we proceed so we can have Sandy and you can ask the man from Kentucky.
Here's what
further. Then other questions or comments? Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. And to Dr. Ziegler, I would just like to acknowledge your many, many, many years of work devoted to improving the quality of education for our nation's children. It's a body of work that you are to be commended for.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you could comment on, in your research and in listening to you, your chronology of what's going on in some of the different states, Hawaii, Missouri, Arkansas, where progress is being made with this agenda. What are the characteristics of the leadership in those states where progress is being made? Who's leading the charge is what I'm asking.
It varies, Senator. It really varies. Some states, like in Connecticut, there was a state legislator who's now gone on to Congress, John Larson, who led the charge. Arkansas was a very interesting case where a group of businessmen in Pear Gould, Arkansas, decided they wanted to see if they could improve education, and they started a school. But what happened in Arkansas is then the state heard about it and it became so popular, and the state became involved secondarily. So we've got Kentucky is an example where it's really a state effort. Different components, of course, have different history. Like the Parents as Teachers program was started by Governor Bond before he became Senator Bond in Missouri. The Hawaii program, a lieutenant governor. So there tends to be champions of these. But it's the state legislatures that really, I think, are the key bodies that either show some leadership and do this or not.
Was that the case in Hawaii where there seems to be some really powerful and positive things happening at the preschool level? I think I heard you say that preschool and after-school programs.
Unfortunately, I couldn't sell Hawaii on the preschool. They have before, but by before school, I mean in the morning when parents go to work and kids could come to school before the school starts and stay after school, and then summer vacation. That's what Hawaii has. It's called the A-plus program.
Is that legislatively?
It's legislated, yes. And interestingly, the history of that is they tried to cut back on it, but they absolutely could not. There was just a rebellion of the parents. Once these schools are in place, it's next impossible not to, because people say we have to have that. And the problem of working women simply have never been dealt with in the United States. We never put into the infrastructure of our society the kind of supports that are necessary to make the modern American family function. And the place parents are the most comfortable in having their children are schools. That's where kids go.
Mr. Chair, I was just in my comment with, you know, there are times when people come before us and, you know, you're just struck by the fact that the contributions that people have made are really great. And that is certainly how I consider Dr. Ziegler. There are also times when you recognize that you're in the presence of an elder and need to be kind of sitting at the feet, learning as much as you can. And I'm just sorry that we don't have more time today to do just that. But again, I can't say enough about your contribution to children in our country. And I thank you for being here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair. Most of the people weren't in the room, I think, as we were starting today, and I just want to reemphasize once again for those of you who joined us later that Dr. Ziegler is the father of Head Start. It was President Johnson asked him to put together a program, and he put it together. And here's a man who could rest on his laurels of saying, yeah, I did a great thing, or sit back and just watch it. He's still out there trying to find new and creative ways. That's kind of exciting, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm always honest. By the way, I did just one thing, though. I remember talking to you, I suppose, a dozen years ago or so, when you said in the beginning you wanted no connection with public schools, with Head Start. You were trying to keep it just as far apart as possible, maybe that was originally the way it was put together. And then you realized to have something to sustain and keep it going that you needed the match. Is that still your thinking? I said it's been a dozen years or so ago since I...
You've got a good memory, Senator Duncan. They're somewhat better than mine. The fact of the matter, I'm sure that's what I said, but you're exactly right.
Yeah.
I think it was Emerson who said that foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds. I used to think there was going to be a different solution. As I pointed out to you, I worked on a federal solution that didn't go anywhere. And the more I thought about this thing, because there's always been an antipathy between Head Start people and school people, which is counterproductive. Head Start kids are going to go to school. We have to make those schools receptive to those children. So there's enough to hate the schools. You have to make them better. And when you stop and think about it, if you're going to have, and Betty Caldwell also did something very smart. Betty Caldwell is a very fine child development person at the University of Arkansas, and she's been around a long time, too. And she said we should never use the word child care. We should have coined the term educare, because this is educational. You're either going to make it education or you're going to lose that opportunity. So that I did change my mind. If you're going to do something, it ought to be comprehensible. I could explain this model to anybody in 5 minutes. And it's essentially tying it to education. That's where children are. That's where parents are comfortable having their children. They're going to wind up there anyway. So just by doing something as simple as extending the length of the day, you've taken care of a big chunk of child care. So you're exactly right, Senator Duncan. I changed my mind. And for better or for ill, presented where I am today, which is a solution. Especially, look, I'm sure it's true of Oregon. I know it's true in Washington, where I spend a lot of my life. The hottest issue in the United States today is education reform. Everybody wants to get on the bandwagon, Democrats, Republicans, what have you. Governor Gray in California just put forward his education reform plan. So, to me, this is just an instance of education reform to make education work and give us the educational achievement that we all aspire to.
Thank you. Dr. Ziegler, it is a great honor to have you here before us today. As you heard a few weeks ago, had some of our leaders from our state Head Start program here in Oregon talking with us about the many benefits. And I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier. You talked about, and I think you were referring to these centers, that for every dollar spent, that $7, about an estimated $7 is saved. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about that, how that comes about, and what it is you were referring to there.
That's one of the best studies ever done. It's a longitudinal study. They started a program, it's called the Perry Preschool Program, Ypsilanti, Michigan. David Weikart was the leading figure in that. But they thought it's a 2-year, very high quality preschool program. Poor children. And what they did is they followed those children, and they had it's a very good research design because it's random assignment. Half the children were assigned to the school and half were not. So it's a very strong evaluation methodology. They then followed the children for 25 years, and they discovered all kinds of benefits, less welfare usage, the most important one, when they did the analysis, if you look at it closely, for the $7 that was saved, $6 of it was in reduced criminality costs. So it's really a crime prevention program as well, as their data show. And we have a whole other body of evidence. I did one review. There's an organization in Washington, and I strongly recommend that you get their last report. It's called Fight Crime, Invest in Children. And it's headed by Sandy Newman. And it's an organization made up of police chiefs, attorney generals from the state, and Elliot Richardson, my old boss, is involved. And reviews show that independent of your school-age programs, that kids who've had this good preschool program do indeed wind up with less delinquency and criminality. I've done one review, which I can make available to you, of all the studies. It's not just high schools that's found this. They found it in Syracuse and many other places. So the reviews indicate that if you really want to do prevention work on crime and delinquency, one of the answers is indeed high-quality preschool education.
Thank you, Chair. Make one quick comment.
Yeah. If you make it quick.
I can do it. It's interesting to note, if he's talking the one for $7, and a number of years ago, Brad Butler was here.
He's the president.
Right. He was the, and you may have heard me mention this before, he was the chairman of the board of Procter & Gamble, and the group of 250 largest CEOs in the country have a forum every year, and they take on an issue. And they were looking at education for the 21st century. And, of course, they started out looking at do we have enough engineers? And then they got into it. They got right down to it, and they got down to early intervention, preschool kinds of things. And he sat in one of these rooms right in here saying, for every $1 you invest, you'll get a $4 return. And his comment at that time is, I spent my entire career looking at balance sheets. And I understand assets and liabilities, and that's not a bad investment. Now, that was probably, Brad was probably here in 86 or so, and now, you know, it's 1 for 7. It tells you something about this. We're letting it get away from those folks if we don't do something soon.
Good. Thank you. You two gentlemen are going to be at the reception in the Galleria tonight from 5 to 6. You're going to be here tomorrow. Also, are you scheduled to appear before other committees tomorrow in the House? At 1 o'clock tomorrow on Tuesday, covering pretty much the same information we are now. Well, that would be great. Those of us, and I agree with Senator Gordley, I just wish we could spend 3 hours with you because, you know, Head Start, in my opinion, we must fund that adequately. That's the first step to stop building prisons. And you just mentioned about the criminology. And so I would like to allow Sandy about 15 minutes, sir, and then I've made commitments to finish the agenda before 3. But
thank you. I am Sandy Griffith. I am the Executive Director of the Office of Family Resource and Youth Service Centers in Kentucky. In order for me to fully flesh this out for you, and I can do it in 15 minutes, I need to let you know that Family Resource and Youth Service Centers is a part of education reform in Kentucky. Education reform in Kentucky started in 1985 when 66 poor school districts sued the legislature for inequitable financial support. November of 1988, a circuit court judge in Franklin County, Kentucky, found for the plaintiffs and indeed said that the system of funding education in Kentucky was inequitable. The legislature, because they were concerned about that, obviously, appealed that to the state Supreme Court, which may have been a mistake, because the state Supreme Court came back and said not only was the system of funding inequitable, but the whole system of education in the state of Kentucky was unconstitutional. and gave the legislature 1 year to come up with a constitutional, that had to be passed by the judicial review, a constitutional system of education in Kentucky. Well, what a wonderful opportunity. Who would ever thought that Kentucky could be a leader in education reform? Because Kentucky has not always been known. You all may be too far away from Kentucky to know what some of the stereotypes are of Kentucky, but eastern Kentucky is called hillbillies and barefoot and pregnant and a lot of other negative kinds of things. So for us to be a leader, particularly on the East Coast and in the East, was somewhat remarkable. The legislature set about doing exactly what they were instructed to do, and they came up with the Kentucky Education Reform Act of 1990. It's a very comprehensive thing, and in 15 minutes I couldn't tell you all the things, but I want to tell you about three things that are there. Ours, obviously, is one I'm going to talk the most about, but I do want to mention to you, one of the things they did was they implemented preschool for all 3-year-olds who have some kind of education delay, disability, some kind of education delay, and for all 4-year-olds that are at risk, and at risk is people eligible for free school meals. That was part one. Part two, they put in place a program called Extended School Services. And extended school services is money that can be used after the school day, before the school day or after the school day, to extend the day for those students who are at risk of falling very far behind, a couple of years behind or failure in courses and that sort of thing. And then they put in place the Family Resource and Youth Service Centers. Now, the interesting thing, I think, about the Family Resource and Youth Service Centers is it came out of the Curriculum Committee of Education Reform. I think that one of the driving forces behind this was, his name escapes me, David Hornbeck, who is now, I think, superintendent of schools in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
At that time, he was a consultant and had done some work, had been in Maryland, as maybe his, whatever.
He was the state superintendent of Maryland.
Yeah, okay. And he was kind of the leader behind putting this part of the program together. We were given a program for Family Resource and Youth Service Centers, and they're two distinct programs, distinct and separate. The Family Resource Center are for children up through age 12. The Youth Service Centers are for children age 12 or above 12. I don't know why somebody in the Legislative Research Commission, who is our research arm of the legislature, didn't figure out that a 12-year-old is generally in the 7th grade, which created a dilemma for us as to what to do with middle school-age children. And most of the schools in Kentucky now have gone to middle school, so we've had some problems with that. But ideally, obviously, an elementary-age child or a middle school-age child would probably be the Family Resource Center and Youth Service Center would be for the older children. And our Family Resource Center is a direct descendant of Dr. Ziegler's work at Yale and his school in the 21st century. He came by way of the Family Resource Centers in Connecticut. They had 3 at that time. We went to work and set about trying to fulfill the 6 components that were given to us by the legislature. Full-time preschool child care for children 2 and 3 years of age. After-school care for children 4 to 12, with the child care being full-time during the summer and the other days when school's not in session. Families in training, which is an integrated approach to home visits, group meetings, and monitoring child development for new and expectant parents. Parent and child education, and we probably adopted that because that's a Kentucky model, PACE, a family literacy model. Support and training for child day care providers, which speaks to Dr. Ziegler's interest in quality, trying to figure out some way to help improve the quality of child care. And then health services and referral to health services are both. That was what we were given. As a staff, we were greatly concerned about how you would tell a school, schools and school boards are relatively independent, how you could tell a school that they were going to have full-time preschool child care for children 2 and 3 year olds in their school. Number one, many of them didn't have enough space. Number two, they had no interest. So we were very concerned about how could we do this and still maintain the integrity of the program. So the way we did it was through a grant process where we allowed the folks to address the issue. We figured out very quickly, and Dr. Ziegler has seconded this on more than one occasion, that it had to be very flexible. It had to meet the needs of the people in the local community. If it didn't do that, what good was it going to be anyway? So when we put the implementation plan, which I have a copy of, the interagency task force, which was made up of 16 different folks that were actually spelled out by the legislature. We put together a program, and we only required three things. Only three things are required. Number one, you must do a local needs assessment. Now, these were intended to work by school, not by district, but by school. Each school was to have this and have enough money, as you can figure, so we had to allow some schools to come together, but they had to do a needs assessment. What are the needs? Secondly, that from that needs assessment, before they had the needs assessment, they had to have an advisory committee. That's the one thing they had to have. An advisory committee had to be one-third parents, not more than one-third educators, because in some cases we knew the educators would overwhelm it. And the other third could be whoever they wanted to be as long as they weren't educators. They could be more parents or they could be community agency or whoever the people wanted to be. And they did the needs assessment. Then as a result of the needs assessment, they were to hire a coordinator that would help them meet the needs that they found. We put no qualifications on the coordinator other than they had to have a full-time coordinator. There had to be a full-time coordinator. And those were the three qualifications. We had no idea what was going to happen. We put an RFP out in January of 1991. In July of 1991, we had gone through the 254 applications we had gotten and had given funding to 133 centers the first year. We started out with 133. Remember, Connecticut had three at the time, or maybe at that time it had gone to six or seven. No other state had any system at all, and we went to 133. And we have a whole variety of things. We've got centers out there, some of which are providing daycare or infants through 3 or 4 year olds, before in school, after child care. So they literally are taking care of children all the way from about 6 weeks of age through the 12 year olds. We have others that do nothing more than refer because they've got plenty of child care around. They don't need to have that. Many of them are running after school child care, but many of the schools already had that, so if they were doing it, we don't want to duplicate it. They just simply say we're already doing it, we work with them, and that's the way it operates. Families in training, the model we use mostly is the parents as teachers, the Missouri model, and it encouraged people, obviously, to do the in-home visits. Parent-child education, because that's such limited funding in Kentucky, it's a specific statute in Kentucky, parent and child education, but it was so limited that we had to amend that legislation at the end of the volume to read PACE or PACE Lite. It's really a family literacy model where the parents get their literacy training and the preschool child gets their preschool training and then they come together at some part during the day and actually work together on literacy. And it works real well. It's a national model. The Kenan Foundation actually adopted that as the national literacy model, and Sharon Darling from our state is the executive director of that in Louisville. The support and training for daycare providers turns out to be a very difficult thing to do because lots of them don't want much help, but we certainly offer them all the training that we would give to any of our folks, and they've been very supportive. And in the health services, what we've done is, in many cases, bring health providers into the schools. One of the things that educators have been concerned about for a long time is children trying to learn in terms of health. Two ways. Number one, if they're not healthy, they don't learn as well. Number two, if they're out of school to go to the health department or to a doctor during the day, they very seldom come back, so they're out a whole day. So they thought if you could bring them on site and do some inoculations and do some other kinds of things, particularly the screening, that would work. So we've been in place now for 8 years. We're up to 602 centers, not all those family resource centers. About 450 of those, I suspect, have the six components of the family resource centers. You could visit a half a dozen of them. You probably wouldn't find the same thing at any one point. They would look very similar, but they would all be different because we wanted the flexibility to allow them to do whatever they want to do locally. We have nothing in there that's mandated. There's nothing that mandates any kind of procedure that any parent would not want a child to be involved in. We think that the advisory council having parents on that has been a very vital part of making sure that it meets the needs and does not overstep the bounds. And so that's where we are.
Thank you.
It is.
It is.
Yes.
I have some comments, because this is not new to me. But this is out of Dr. Ziegler's information. This is from Yale, and it says, right here at the bottom, it says, the School of the 21st Century, also known as Family Resource Centers in some communities, is a school-based child care family support model that transforms the school into a year-round multi-service center providing services from morning to evening. And that's what I was talking about. Some parents still want to send their kids to school and not to the welfare office to educate their children. And my big thing about education reform is the proof is in the pudding. And that is, what about the scores? You have to have a record of success. And right here in your information, it talks about summary of findings. Number 4, there is no relationship between youth service centers and ACT scores was found. There was no relationship. And that's the whole point of us, our education dollars, is to educate our kids and for them to score well on the SAT. Also, it said these FR Family Resource Centers are to promote these services, and they include referrals to health and social services, employment counseling, training and placement, drug and alcohol abuse counseling. I'm sorry, but I don't want our alcoholics roaming around the schools looking for the alcohol abuse counseling center, the family crisis and the mental health counseling. And I don't think all the people that need mental health should have access to the school. Child care, that seems to work. It says that the desired outcome was improved academic performance. And over here, it says that the Kentucky Instructional Results Information System, which is KIRIS, and I'm sorry I don't have it here, but up in my office, I have a newspaper clipping from a city in Kentucky. And those kids had consistently scored at the top of the SAT and the ACTs, but they couldn't pass the KIRIS because it was more social attitudes. And the kids that are in these daycare school centers, their scores are improving on these KIRIS because it's having an effect changing their social beliefs. And I think schools are there to teach academics. But in summary, on the last page, it says the ACT scores, and those are standardized. And that's what I think, if I were a parent in Kentucky, I would be concerned about, because my kids are going to have to compete against the kids in New Jersey, North Dakota, Oregon, and not against the kids in the cities in Kentucky about how they feel about their society. And it says here that the schools having centers on their academic scores, the ACT, declined, while schools without centers increased. Now, the difference was not statistically significant, but it was a decline in the national standardized academic test. And the results of it, in conclusion, you said, or whoever wrote this, the results of this study are mixed as to whether these family resource centers are making progress towards the desired goal of improved academic performance. And I have a little difference of opinion. I think education dollars should go to education and human resource dollars should go to child care. And I just think that it muddies the water and thins out our education quality of when we start having the welfare office in the schools and all the drug counseling and all that.
Can I speak to that, please?
Sure.
I'm from Kentucky.
Sure. I know parents from Kentucky, too.
Okay. And let me say again, Sandy, the senator said, sure, you can speak to it. And as a parent, I say you can't do it if you keep it very short. And we'll probably
just let them
know. She can carry on with this in front of the House Human Resources Committee.
I won't be there. This is my shot.
Okay.
Let me just say this. Number one, the CARES assessment, no child who has gone through the Education Reform Act has ever taken the CARES assessment yet, because the play only been in place 8 years. So the ones that are being tested, and the test results are the results of things that have been done to them up to this point by educators, whatever those things are, good, bad, or indifferent. And I happen to think the public education is pretty good. I'm a public educator, so I wouldn't actually say that. The indications were, as they began to take the test at the 4th, 8th, and 12th grades, then they lowered it to the 11th grade. The fourth graders showed gains. The eighth graders were mixed, but began to show gains toward the end of the life of Karen. And then the 12th graders never did show much because they never did get full, I would think, full load. As a result of some issues with Curis, it has been changed. There will no longer be Curis. They moved to another system called CATS. And we'll see what CATS does when we get to that. And I don't even know what that acronym stands for.
Okay. I'm fine. I do have to move on now. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And so I close the informational meeting and open the public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1093 and Janet Phillips, please. Welcome to the committee, Jen. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Janet Phillips. I'm legal counsel for the Oregon Health Sciences University, and I've been asked to go through the Senate Bill 1093-1, which includes amendments to 1093. Just by way of a brief background, one reason that the lawyer is here to explain these to you is that we view the changes that are proposed to our legislation as being clarifications to our existing bill or housekeeping, although some of them are more important housekeeping provisions than others. We don't view any of these as changes in policy. What I propose to do is go through this not on a line-by-line basis, but sort of page-by-page and generally describe what each of the proposed changes are, and of course would entertain questions at any time, Mr. Sure. Chairman, that you want to allow those. The first change that we're requesting is, you might recall that under the legislation, the president of the university is a member of the board of directors and is considered a full member and votes. However, there is a provision in the legislation that says that no voting member may be an employee of the university. So those two provisions are clearly in conflict, and that's the first clarification we're asking for, that except for the president of the university, no other voting member can be an employee of the university.
So we're on page 2, line
3. We're on page 2. Line 21.
Okay.
Some of the changes are so editorial. For example, changing the State Board of Higher Education to State System, whatever their name change is, but I won't mention those because they're just word changes. The second change is also on page 2. It begins on page 2, towards the bottom of the page, line 35, and there are a number of provisions in what's called the power and authority section of the statute, which specifically delegates to OHSU certain powers and authorities, and it's a long, long list of actions that the university is authorized to carry out that are typically powers that you would find in other similar enabling statutes, such as the State System of Higher Ed, and are also typically powers that you would find granted to any sort of corporate authority. There is a bit of an inconsistency throughout the powers section. Sometimes there's a reference to the board has authority. Sometimes there are references to the university, which we interpret generally to be university management. So the practice of the board is to be very involved in policy making as well as overview of management decisions and activities, but obviously not to become involved on a day-by-day basis on the approval of all 800 or 1,000 contracts per year that the university might be involved in, just by way of example. And so what we're proposing is to change the inconsistent references to the board to instead read as powers granted to the university. And by way of example, the board has been granted the authority to purchase insurance. Another example is the board has been granted authority to lease the university facilities. And my best example of that is there's this little delicatessen in a building in the university, and it's not one of these big cafeteria companies. It's just a little deli that leases space and makes great sandwiches. Well, approving that little lease does not really rise to the level of board activity. Another example is that the different state agencies are authorized to enter into contracts to provide services to the university. Again, that type of contract is not the kind of contract that would normally go to the board for approval. We have a contract policy, very comprehensive, that the managers are responsible for working out the details of those contracts. So that's a general explanation of all of the various little changes from converting the word board to the word university. On page 3, towards the bottom, line 43, the next change is, you'll see actually on line 40, that the university does have the authority to impose fines and fees for violating parking regulations. Both our parking department and the legal counsel who advises our parking department felt that more comprehensive language was advised in order to make it very clear that not only can fees be assessed for parking violations, but they can be collected in accordance with the same system that we've always used, dating from the time we were part of the state system of higher education. And in brief, what that does is it allows us to go through the district court system to send out the notice that, you know, your parking fine is overdue. Page 4, the next change begins on line 3. This provision, subsection 16, authorizes the university to commission its security officers with probable cause arrest authority. This is language that was actually granted to the state system of higher education many years ago. It has never been invoked. Our security officers act as security officers and do not currently exercise the probable cause arrest authority, but in the event that ever occurs, there may be occasions when, because of the controversial nature of a decision by the university, such as an animal research project, for example, then it may be a good idea to also hire retired police officers as on a contract basis to come in who would not be employees necessarily of the university, but would be working as independent contractors. Currently, the language restricts hiring security officers and granting them probable cause arrest authority only to employees, which is, from a management standpoint, it's kind of an unnecessary restriction. In the event it's helpful to hire a company or, like I said, a retired police officer to come in if there's some kind of special enhanced need to ensure that ticketing goes without any sort of problem, we would just like to have the same flexibility to hire outsiders as commission our employees to do that work. The next change is not until page 6. And on page 6, starting in line 19, it's not on the printed version, but it would be in your dash 1 version. We are asking to include in the list of statutes which the university is exempt from, exemption from ORS chapter 294. That statute has several provisions, some of which don't apply to the university, such as the local budget law and tax supervising and commission. But the one that is designated for this particular change is the statutory restrictions on the investment of certain funds. It was our belief and our understanding that when the university was created as a public corporation, that policies that set out how university funds and reserves would be managed and invested, that authority would be vested in the OHSU board. And that's the reason for this request. As somewhat of a background, our board has adopted an investment policy, which we feel is fairly conservative. It obviously tracks the current statutory language. There are some examples of investments that could return a greater, give us a greater return than what is currently allowed under Chapter 294. One example that's been given to me is that there are certain types of commercial paper that the university can invest in, but there's an 18-month limit on the investment. Whereas there are some, the same commercial paper, if we could invest it for a 24 or 48-month period, there are times when the yields would be much higher, and we would like to be able to take advantage of that type of flexibility. And that's the reason for requesting an exemption from Chapter 294. The second,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Gordy,
the line that you're looking at on the dash one amendment is what? The line or lines?
The dash one amendment is page five, excuse me, line five, page one of the dash one amendment. After the number 293, insert the number 294.
Thank you.
Okay. The second portion of that dash one amendment is to delete 190.410. That statute requires that certain interstate contracts where the university would contract, say, with a state university in another state, is submitted to the Attorney General's office for review. We're not quite sure of the genesis of that. It certainly is not specific to OHSU, but since the university is no longer a state agency, it doesn't use the Attorney General's office for legal services for any purpose. And our attorneys review these contracts, and it just seems rather redundant to also submit it to the AG's office. It's not like there's any sort of dispute. It just is not very efficient, and it's it doesn't make sense since we do have outside counsel and inside counsel to review these contracts. Then on line 20 of page 6, which in the dash amendment is line 7, the request is to delete the ORS number 192.660 subsection 3, and that is a mistake. We inadvertently, in the printing process, or at some point, I couldn't tell you when, that statute would have resulted in the university board being completely exempt from any sort of executive session meeting where the press might be public, and we're not asking that broad of an exemption from the open meetings law. In a few minutes, I will explain another exemption that we are asking for. In terms of an exemption from the open meetings law, it's much narrower than this. This was inadvertently included, so we're not trying to exclude the press. And I don't know if anybody caught onto that, but we wanted to make sure that that mistake wasn't made. The next change is on page 7 of the main bill, 1093, line 15 requires that any personnel records that are maintained at the university have to be limited to 3 official records. This is a holdover from language that the state system of higher education currently uses. Limiting the number of personnel files to 3 is not possible in the university because of the various functions that a health sciences university and hospital is legally required to maintain. For example, we have the provost's office, and which is the official personnel office for faculty members. Each dean of the school obviously has a record of offer letters and that sort of thing. Each department tends to maintain their own personnel file. But in the case of medical faculty, just as an example, the Joint Commission on the Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations requires the hospital to maintain a credentialing file. Doctors in a hospital are required to be organized in what's called a medical staff. They are legally required to maintain the equivalent of personnel files for each of the doctors who have been given credentials and may or may not run into problems that require some review and peer process. So we're asking that the limitation to 3 personnel files be lifted so that we can proceed with what's more functionally accurate within the university setting. The next,
Mr. Sharon. Looking at the text in the remarks that accompany the bill, looks like you want another exemption from the state archivist requirements for retention of public records. Why is that needed?
Because what we've discovered is, again, because of the nature of the work, the operation of the university, there are many state archivist policies and regulations that simply don't apply to the university, and so we're constantly trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Someone may say, well, how long do we have to keep a record of research, this research project by involving human subjects that was approved by the federally mandated Human Resource Institutional Review Board? There is no equivalent within the state archivist regulations. And it's happened often enough that, again, since the university is not a state agency any longer, it is requesting that it continue to develop its own records retention policy as other public bodies do that are not state agencies.
Okay.
Okay. The next change is on page 9, line 2, inclusion of the word rent. Our bond council, this statute relates to the university's authority and regulations under which it can issue bonds. And our bond council has requested clarification that we replace the word properties with the word rents to make it clear to potential investors that any rental income that accrues to the university is included in its overall assets. The next comment of substance is on page 11. Beginning at line 40, which actually is more it's also included in the Dash 1 amendment on page 1, beginning at line 18, and continuing takes up most of page 2 and most of page 3. This section introduces what we strongly believe is a needed clarification to the university's ability to maintain complete care, custody, and control of the real property on which university buildings are situated and university operations take place. The language that was included in the original legislation was a model of brevity, but after the legislation was over, we determined and learned that the devil was in the details, because the brief language said what I just said a few moments ago, that the university has exclusive care, custody, and control of the real property on which all university buildings are located and on which all university activities take place. It was certainly apparent to the committees as well as to the witnesses who testified that the purpose, the intent of that statute was to vest exclusive authority and control of the property with the university. Shortly after the public corporation legislation became effective, the university went out on its first bond issue, and in working with our bond council and with quite a few other people, what we learned is that we needed a lease, and I think that didn't come as a complete surprise, because we had been told we needed to have a lease between the state and the university, even though we had this legislation. And in working on the lease and trying to come up with a detailed language, it just wasn't very clear to some of the participants who had not been involved in the legislative process. And I'm thinking about the state administrators with DAS and the higher ed system, as well as the Attorney General's office. They didn't get a real clear idea of exactly what that brief language was intended to convey. And as a result, it turned out to be ambiguous to all of us. We came away from the discussions, which went on for quite some time leading up to our bond sale, with a very conservative approach to the initial lease, where the underlying property, which is still owned by the state of Oregon, is leased to the university for a period of 50 years, which may sound like a lot of time, but our bonds are 20-year bond periods, and 50 years is a fixed term. So, of course, the closer every year gets us closer to the end of 50 years, and although it may not seem like a lot of time, or it may seem like it is a lot of time, it's not a lot of time to potential investors. And we were strongly advised by our bond counsel and by the other people who were involved in this, including the underwriters counsel, that we really needed to come back and seek clarification of this statute to tell the next wave of potential investors that the university really did have exclusive control over the real property. Otherwise, the fear is that as time marched on, it would become more and more difficult to convince investors that we were actually a very solid investment, out of potential fear that the real property could go away and thus their investment would be harmed. This provision is much longer than only changing the term of the lease from 50 years to 99 years, which is renewable. But the other provisions are likewise actually taken from the lease and are consistent with what the term of the lease is. I've tried to explain as best I can from my participation in those events what it means. If you have any specific questions, though, about the effect that this could potentially have on future bond sales, our bond counsel, Ann Sherman, is here today to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to know how this information and this proposal was received by the Senate Budget Committee when you provided testimony about the problem that needs fixing.
How it was delivered to the Senate Budget Committee?
How did the Senate Budget Committee respond to your request? Part of the request is extending the existing lease from 50 years to 99 years.
I can't answer that. I don't know. There might be someone here who can answer that question. I guess I'm not aware that it was that any sort of question was ever presented as by any other committee as a concern.
Well, I'm looking at, I'm trying to follow a document that was dated April 5th to members of the Senate Education Committee.
Is that the subcommittee that we're here?
No. It's from Sue Hilgit.
Sue, could you come to the desk?
Director of Government Relations. And in Ms. Hilgit's memorandum, she's covering some of the same points that she's expanding on some of the same points that you're making. And Ms. Hilgit, you indicated in your statement that there was a presentation to the Senate Budget Committee, and I'm just trying to find out how this information was received. Did they frown on it, like the idea, say let's do it, or what?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Sue Hilbig, Director of Government Relations at OHSU. Senator Gorsley, we did present our budget packages to the Senate Budget Committee, and at that time, we were asked whether there were changes to our statute that were needed. And we brought up the idea of a transfer of the property to OHSU. We were looking at it at the time. And I think that the chairman, Senator Bryant, at the time said that he would need to look at that further. Since that time, as you can see, we're not asking for a transfer of the property. We're simply asking for an extension of the lease. So the only dialogue we had with the Senate Budget Committee was on the transfer issue.
Okay. I think I've got it.
Let's see. Are you speaking about the Senate Budget Committee during the interim?
Yeah.
So where do you get this April 5th date?
Well, I'm looking at a memorandum here that's dated April 5th, 1999, from Sue Hilbig to members of the Senate Education Committee regarding background on Senate Bill 1093. And as I've been following our discussion about the bill and the recommended changes in the bill, I've also been following Ms. Hilbig's memorandum trying to
will justify the two sets of information. So if I'm confusing that as for other members, I apologize, but I'm just trying to understand.
Good.
Now, that is the memo we gave to every member of the committee that walks through each of the changes.
Right.
Okay. Proceed.
The next change is on page 15 of Senate Bill 1093, line 2. And this provision, as well as a similar provision, which I'll point out on line 17, will allow potential donors who wish to remain anonymous to not have their identity disclosed through the Public Records Act. There are many people who wish to donate money to a variety of good causes, including the university, who don't want their name made known for personal reasons, and this would allow those donations to occur and discussions with potential donors to occur.
Mr. Chair, I've lost
disclosure.
I've lost you. Where are you again?
Page 15, beginning on line 2.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. It's
okay. And that there are some a few editorial grammatical changes that dash 1 makes to that provision. There's a companion provision on page 17, beginning on line 13, again, which relates to the privacy of anonymous donors. The next change is on page 20. There are two changes on page 20, but they are they address the same issue. This is the matter that I referred to earlier regarding an exemption request that we are asking for from the open meetings law. The request is that the board of directors be allowed to discuss sensitive business, financial, or commercial matters of the university that are not customarily provided to competitors outside the context of the open meetings law. And this is one of a number of exemptions from the open meetings law that the law provides, as you'll see in the previous line. Let me go back to 1995 and talk to you about what our experience was in testifying before the legislature, what the legislative history shows. Our current board chair is Frederick Buckman. Other board members, in addition to Dr. Kohler, are Mike Thorne, federal state representative, now Port of Portland director, Neil Goldschmidt, Trish Smith, who's a very active member of the Bend area, a student named Jeff Hart, and Tom Imeson, who's works for Pacific Corps and has a long history in government as well as corporate work areas. When Mr. Buckman testified to the committee, he brought with him a committee to the legislative committees. He brought with him committee reports from a group of private people that included Mr. Goldschmidt as well as Mr. Thorne. And in his testimony, he explained that the legislature was being asked to grant the university two exemptions to the public records and the open meetings law. The one exemption was to allow the board to conduct the search process for university presidents not outside the context of the open meetings law. In other words, to do that in private settings. The other, and that was granted. The other request was that the university be exempt from the public records law, which is disclosure of public records, as well as the open meetings law, for discussing any matter, and the language is that language that's before you now, of sensitive business, financial, or commercial matters of the university not customarily provided to competitors. That exemption was also approved in the public records law setting. As I looked through the legislative history, there was there were certainly questions, but there was no disagreement from the representatives on the various committees, and it was very clear that that was the request that we thought was being asked for, so that there would be a parallel
ability to act more in a more competitive sense between the public records law and the open meetings law. On the one hand, public records that are very sensitive commercial matters you wouldn't usually share with a competitor are exempt. And on the other hand, the board can also discuss those matters. For reasons that are not clear in reviewing the legislative history, three of the four exemptions were found their way into the legislation. And I can't say it was inadvertent, but I also can't say it was intentional that this exemption from the open meetings law was omitted. As time has gone on, it's become very apparent to the board that it is important to them, and it's apparent to those of us who serve the board that it's important for management to be able to go to the board and discuss in a private setting a matter of commercial and proprietary sensitivity that a regular we wouldn't ordinarily share with a competitor. An example of that is as the people who lead our strategic planning in developing a presence in the community in clinics so that people can have access to OHSU other than just up on the hill, there may be studies done that lead management to conclude that it's a really great idea to set a clinic out in this neighborhood because this is where there are a number of current patients, there's a need there, and that's the sort of information that needs to be shared with the board. On some level, the board may even want to weigh in and take on a decision-making role. That's very sensitive, competitive information. All of our competitors, and I have to say that, I mean, OHSU is involved in a very competitive commercial environment for a good share of its work. All of our competitors are nonprofit hospitals that have a legal obligation to do good work, just the same as OHSU. None of them are required to share commercial information or information that they wouldn't ordinarily send out to their competitors. By not allowing our board to discuss this type of information in private, it puts us at a competitive disadvantage. And it also creates the possibility, although we've tried hard to work around it, that management can't talk about some things in public to the board because it would be competitively disastrous. But then they also can't talk in private to the board because it's not clear that the exemption made its way into the legislation. That's the purpose for coming back to you now and asking that for what we view as a clarification, and it's not new language. It is the same language as currently exists in the exemption from the Public Records Act, and we're asking for clarification for that exemption. One additional language here that you do not find in the Public Records Act exemption is relates to faculty or staff committee meetings. There are.
Could we just backtrack a bit? And could you share with us in the legislative history that you indicated you reviewed, what questions were raised during those legislative hearings about this this particular issue, the open meetings issue?
On the open meeting side, the comment about this exception to the open meetings law came in Fred Buckland's testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the middle of a fair amount of testimony. I didn't find anything before that or after that where questions were asked about it. There, at some point in the process, there was testimony from, it was fairly late in the process, there was testimony from a trade association representing publishers where concern was expressed by the publishing association that the public records side of exemption from university president searches as well as the exemption for this language caused them concern. And they voiced their concerns, and it was not accepted by the committee, which passed out the exceptions as is. This particular language was taken I wouldn't say verbatim, but very closely parallels a federal exception to the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, has a number of exceptions as well. And there is an exception in the federal public records law for this type of information. That's what it was built on. And there was a question and concern raised about it from the media, mm-hmm. but it was not accepted.
Let me explore something else with you. Looking at the changes then on page 20, starting with that line 23, and the phrase sensitive business, regarding sensitive business,
mm-hmm.
what might that encompass? For example, if the board was wanting to have a conversation about whether to continue its commitments to serve poor folks.
How does that intersect with this?
I need a definition of sensitive business. What is that in the board? Mm-hmm.
I think that one could say that that's what that this sensitive business might include, that type of discussion. However, any discussion on any business matter, if it's financial or whatever, that leads to a decision leads to a financial decision, and that's an example of what could be a very significant financial decision.
And the way that this is framed, though, financial or commercial matters of the university, not customarily provided to competitors, is a separate phrase. It's separated from sensitive business, so I'm trying to understand the difference. Are you looking at the difference?
The intent, and I think the statutory interpretation would work this way, and legislative history is helpful for that reason. The intent is that sensitive is the lead-in to the clause. Business, financial, or commercial matters is the definition of matters that would be considered sensitive. And all three of those matters would have to be a matter that would not ordinarily be shared with a competitor in order to qualify for the exemption. So in other words, simply, I probably can't come up with an example, but a sensitive business matter that does not somehow relate to our competitive environment would not necessarily be subject to this exemption.
Mm-hmm. Well, has the board been, in its experience, since this became law, how has the board been stifled in its discussion?
It's stifled in the sense of trying to get the entire board together to talk in one time, in one place, talk about extremely important financial and competitive matters. Because, and this is, I hope this isn't a surprise, but the way that any public body addresses restrictions, what's viewed as a restriction imposed by the open meetings law, is you look at how you define a quorum. And if a quorum exists, you figure out how to not have a quorum exist. And so in a county, for example, that has three board members, two of the three can never get together and have a conversation outside of open meetings law, open meetings segment. So what happens is staff has to go to one board member, then the other, then the other.
Mm-hmm.
And
excuse me, could we interrupt right here and Senator Courtney, can you go to executive session?
The executive session does not allow for a purely private conversation without the media. And that's...
The media doesn't report.
But that's not been the experience that was relayed in the last in the 1995 session. That wasn't the experience that some of our current board leadership has had with the press attending executive session.
Well, because I was in the City Council, and once they violate it, it's a whole different ballgame. But the rules and rules are they can go in, but they can't report. Now, often the press will choose not to go in because it compromises them. They will choose not to go in because it will compromise them. If they can go in, they can't report. Now, if they choose to violate that, then we're in another whole ballgame. So I do think that the The role of executive session, the open meetings law, was designed specifically so you could go in and discuss very sensitive, whether it's personnel matters or land purchases, et cetera, et cetera. I've been a part of all these when I was on the film city council involving personnel matters as well as land deals. Mm-hmm. And the press never chose to come in, the Statesman Journal, because they didn't want to be compromised, but they were invited in. And so I'm somewhat confused here as to how this is impossible to do because of the press or something else like that. I mean, I'm not going to make a big deal of it, but my view of the executive session is a whole lot different than what's being represented here.
Mr. Sheriff, can I finish my question?
Okay, excuse me.
Yeah. Have there been violations since 95?
Of our, I don't believe so.
Because there was the post-95 experience, and now since 95.
There's certainly been frustration by the board, which is comprised of people who are accustomed to working in a corporate setting where there's a free exchange of information. So I would say frustration, yes, violation.
Frustration, but that's not the same as violation.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. And if I could, Mr. Chair, to respond to Senator Courtney's comments.
And then Senator Duncan and then Senator Castillo.
One thing that we always have to remember and return ourselves to is that although, as in the case of the city or other public bodies, we have some fraction of our, and a very important fraction of our revenue coming from public funds, 90% of what generates the university revenue comes from a competitive enterprise, a commercial enterprise, where having the opportunity for the leadership of our organization to have a free, completely unshielded exchange of information without any risk on their part that it would be disclosed to a competitor is simply creating a level playing field. And that's really what the overall purpose of the legislation was intended to accomplish, to put us on a level playing field with the Sisters of Providence and with the legacy health system, which are also nonprofit, tax-exempt, doing important public missions, but do not have the requirement that anyone be invited into strategic planning sessions or other discussions where very sensitive competitive information central to the commercial enterprise is being divulged.
Senator Courtney, are you done?
I don't think it's a fair comparison to talk about province or those kinds of hospitals or University of Oregon Health Science Center unless the legislature wants to put University of Oregon Health Science Center in the same categories as those particular hospitals when you're talking about the open meetings law. I really don't. We are under assault in this session, and I can tell you in the Senate Judiciary Committee, to make exception after exception after exception to the open meetings law, to exempt everything under the sun. And this is just another example of it. If you're going to do it, then cut the University of Oregon Health Science Center loose, let it operate as some corporation, and give you that. But otherwise, what's the open meetings law about? What's the executive session all about? And I'm sorry you deal with a lot of private individuals who work in the executive world and CEOs, and they're not used to the fact that you've got the media in the room and you have to trust that they won't report the thing. I'm sorry about that. And there's been some violations, Senator Boone. I'm sorry about that. That's not the way the rules of games are. It wasn't the way when I was in the Salem City Council, and we had some very sensitive stuff going on. So, again, I don't want to get all huffy about this because this is a huge bill, I guess. There's 5,000 amendments to it. I feel I'm back in 1995 where I voted no. I'm probably going to vote yes on this thing. But I am very concerned about all this stuff going on behind closed door University of Oregon Health Science Center and representations are being made about it.
Well, I understand. And, the discussion we're having now didn't really come up in the 95 session when we had Senate Bill 2, I believe it was, that made HSU a public corporation. But now we've got a little track record. And this is a serious problem. You know, the state wanted to remain connected with OHSU because of the teaching and the research and all that sort of thing. But should we have spun you off completely in terms of being competitive with the different other healthcare? I don't know. And I think that's the question that Senator Courtney is raising. Maybe we didn't go far enough when we made OHSU a public corporation?
I can say, Mr. Chairman, that the leadership of the university takes very strongly its public missions and its obligation to public accountability for really all of its activities, but in particular its public missions. And this certainly would not exempt from the open meetings law any discussion regarding student enrollment or other aspects of our educational commitment or our research program. It really is dedicated and addressed to our competitive setting in the healthcare industry as it stands now.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Duncan?
Well, Mr. Chair, I had a note from you that I very likely would be carrying this bill.
Yes, that's
right. I have some concerns. It looks to me like this is really a hot spot. And I look at the bill. You have a lot of things in here you want. I guess the question I have, are you willing to go for broke, or is this an element that you might want to consider leaving out and working separately? Because my guess right now is you could have a lot of difficulty with this bill on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you would obviously be concerned. If I'd be carrying it, I also would be extremely concerned. I have a little hard time. I understand, and I appreciate the fact that corporate people are used to going off in their kind of own little world, and that's okay, but it's a little bit different. I worked with state boards of education where you got caught in the same kind of mind. Many times it would have been nice to be able to say, oh, I'd just like to take them aside and talk to them, but I just don't think I get a lot of sympathy out of it, frankly.
This is a high priority item within the bill, Senator.
In other words, you were just, if the whole thing went down, are other things in there important enough that you could let the whole thing go because of this effect?
I believe that the three substantive items in particular are Chapter 294, the exemption there, the language concerning the real property, and this item. Everything else really is kind of scrivening.
Mm-hmm.
And this item in particular is considered very central to the ability of the university to act in a truly business-like fashion for that aspect of its work that is dedicated to, one way, like it or not, is part of a commercial and competitive industry. Since, as you said, Senator, you would have to be carrying the bill, if you have concerns, and then we clearly need to do everything that we can to help you with that and to address whatever concerns you have, but this is a very high priority item.
Thank you. You know, we do have to vacate this room, and Senator Duncan, would you please get together with these two parties and with Senator Courtney, too, to address this, because I think we are confronted with separating some things out of this law. I agree with you that we'd have a tough time on the floor with this. It's part of the amendments that we're just talking about.
I might have trouble
in committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, since I raised the issue, it would be nice if they came to visit me as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe so we just reschedule this for...
Yeah.
Let's do that, because there's enough people interested. So we will reschedule this for a hearing later, and so I'll close the public hearing and the possible work session on 1093, and we do have to vacate the room.